910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Daria Aldinger. CrowdStrike says it has a fix for what caused the global cyber outage, but it could be days before things are back to normal at all businesses affected, especially the world's airport.
That screen is not normal.
Information displays at American airports showing that so-called blue screen of death error message. Luggage piled high at LAX. Stranded travelers packing airports in Madrid and Dubai. Some airlines resorting to handwritten boarding passes.
ABC's Ariel Reshef. Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown, one of the latest Democratic lawmakers urging President Biden to end his reelection campaign, saying it could impact down ballot races, including some in his state. The Fork Fire in Southern California is growing alarmingly quickly, consuming 250 acres in a matter of hours. American journalist Evan Gerskovich is convicted of espionage and sentenced to 16 years in prison. This is ABC News.
I'm James Kelly with WBZH News. Your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WBZH website at buzzofthenorth.com.
News, I'm Ella Saff. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Vice President Kamala Harris will be visiting Milwaukee next Tuesday for a campaign event. Harris has already visited Wisconsin four times this year. The vice president's arrival in Milwaukee will come just days after the city hosted the Republican National Convention. Harris last visited Milwaukee in May, where she discussed her administration's economic policies. Two Ohio police officers who shot and killed a man outside the Republican National Convention have been investigated in the past for uses of force. Nicholas Mason was cleared of charges in 2017 after killing a man during a traffic stop. Adam Groves was sued in 2016 for wrongful arrest and excessive use of force. Mason and Groves were part of a visiting police bicycle unit from Columbus. Activists and mourners of Samuel Sharp Jr., the man shot and killed, are criticizing Milwaukee officials for hosting the RNC and bringing in out-of-state police. And that's what you need to know. I'm Ella Saff, and this is Civic Media News.
I'm Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. I learned about atrial fibrillation the hard way. My symptoms would come and go, shortness of breath, fatigue. I kept going. Then I got so lightheaded, I couldn't. My doctor said I have AFib, so I'm about five times more likely to have a stroke. Other symptoms, irregular heartbeat, heart racing, chest pain, can come and go, but the risk of stroke stays. If you have symptoms, tell a doctor. Visit notimetowait.com.
Sponsored by Bristol-Myers Squibb and Pfizer.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Up North News Radio.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. You know, we've been talking about Monday night speech of Teamsters President Sean O'Brien. More keeps coming out about the relationships that President O'Brien has been making over the last several months. I was surprised at the bromance with Josh Hawley. I had very nice things to say about J.D. Vance. And even the guy that, you know, anytime, cowboy. Turns out they're like besties now. Evidently, Donald Trump went and got them together, and they went to a little Italian restaurant together, and Sean apologized, and now they text each other and all that. And they now, according to Mark Wayne Mullen, because I happened to be watching CNN, saw this. I'm like, wow, this is great. This is great news. All of this pandering is paying off. All of this, you know, outreach to the Republicans is paying off for Sean. I mean, I got to know who picked up the check, but it seems like he's making inroads with Republicans, and that's a good thing. The question is, if they're besties, when's one of their names going to show up on the PRO Act? When is one of their names going to show up on a piece of legislation that is going to benefit working people and not, and this is the important part here, and not solely be in the best interest of them politically? Because understand, you know, there are some moments, very few, but there are some moments where there's a piece of legislation that would somewhat, maybe, possibly, and in some small way help working people that Republicans would support, you know, obviously there's got to be something in there for the business interest, but there are those times, as rare as they may be. Now, look, you know, I look at this to go, it's great. It's absolutely great that they're making inroads because, hey, why not? But then I look at Scott Walker, and Scott Walker reiterated a line kind of from O'Brien's speech where he said, you know, workers have gotten screwed by politicians in Washington. Now, this is coming from a guy who's probably one of the worst offenders of screwing workers over while he was governor. It's kind of like a serial killer saying, you know, the crime rate's too high. The Republican Party is not the party of workers, is not the party that's going to stand up. In fact, it's probably one of the greatest fictions that the GOP is somehow this working class party. It's ridiculous. Now, what's interesting to me, is that the National Review, the right-wing conservative publication, they wrote a piece on this, you know, Trump Teamsters, ? And in the piece, the guy was spot on. He said, look, the temptation for Republicans would be to think that they could gain even greater union support by leaning left on union issues. That probably wouldn't make much difference, and it isn't worth trying, he says. Trump's appeal to union members is likely just an extension of his appeal to the working class voters generally. In short, it's cultural, not ideological. And this is, you know, I got to be quite honest, this is the reality. It's the cult of personality. It's not the policies. Because you ask the average Red Hat union member, they don't know how bad Donald Trump was. And even the good folks there at the National Review said Trump's administration leaned right in its labor policies, rolling back several Obama-era policies. And that doesn't seem to have blunted his appeal. It's likely that many rank and files aren't even that big on their unions. So they're taking a shot at that and saying, look, he's going to go back to where he was. They said for Trump, giving the Teamsters a speaking spot is a no-brainer. It gives him another way to demonstrate his appeal to blue-collar Americans. For O'Brien, it's an attempt to build a working relationship with what may very well be the next presidential administration. And we've seen how Trump deals with people under the bus with you. It's cultural, not ideological. And this is the point that's important, because these folks, they're not voting for labor-friendly legislation. They're not voting to make workers' lives better. They may take you to a nice Italian restaurant, wine you, dine you, but ultimately, you know what comes after that. So here we are. And look, if Trump is reelected, all of those horrible policies come back. All of those attacks on all of the workers in this country, even Teamsters, all of the horrible Labor Relations Board decisions, all of the Supreme Court decisions, all of that comes back, and in a big way. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Gonna take a quick break. Craig Harrington after this. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So what a fun week of political theater it has been. One of my favorite storylines, Peter Navarro, you know, Trump advisor, Project 2025 guy, gets out of prison, released from prison, straight to the Republican National Convention to spew some nonsense to the faithful there. But I thought it was interesting because the guy who's running for Senate out in Montana, this guy Tim Sheehy, he said common sense is simple. Criminals are bad. And yet you've got a felon at the top of the ticket and a bunch of folks showing up. Paul Manafort was there. It's kind of like a collection, like a reunion, if you will, of the criminal element. But here's the thing. After Navarro told some tales of prison, he turned his tales to Joe Biden and Biden inflation. And he said that inflation is coming after what's left of your savings and eating your wages. And yeah, a lot of fear. And here to share some thoughts on, what's going on at the RNC and maybe what we should be fearing. I've asked our good friend Craig Harrington to come talk with us. Craig's the research director there at Media Matters, Media Matters for America, mediamatters.org, the website. Craig, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me again.
So what do you make of this? You got Navarro shows right up there. I think it would have been better if he was still in his prison garb. That would have been fun. But any thoughts?
Yeah, it was very interesting. So Peter Navarro, for anyone who needs to be caught up, it's difficult to call him right wing. He's a Trump aligned, somewhat extremist economist who, in addition to being a senior trade policy and economic policy advisor for Trump during his 2016 campaign and throughout his first administration, Peter Navarro somehow found himself involved in the efforts to manufacture the theft of the 2020 election and to overturn the results on January 6th. It was his involvement in that, his refusal to answer questions under subpoena about his involvement in January 6th, and his being held in contempt of Congress, held in criminal contempt, that resulted in him going to prison. He just finished a one-month stay as a federal inmate. And like you said, within a few hours of leaving prison, was giving a speech at the Republican National Convention. And like you said, there was a great deal of irony there to have, here's this guy, a literal ex-con, giving a speech in the evening in primetime at the Republican convention, when less than 24 hours previously, the Attorney General, I believe, of Iowa was speaking at the convention, talking about, again, how the Republicans are the ones who are tough on crime and not embracing of criminals. Not only was the convention itself actually nominating a convicted felon to be the presidential nominee of the Republican Party, but here was another felon, another convict, who was giving a speech at that convention on the same floor. The irony really couldn't, if you had written that character in your novel, your editor would have told you it was a bit too on the nose. But so he's giving the speech and he's hyping the threat of Biden inflation. And he's simply just getting the facts wrong. He misled the audience and he misled the viewers, who were tuning into the RNC. The simple fact of the matter is inflation has been roughly flat and on a downward trajectory for the past year. There was a transitory spike in 2021 and 2022. In the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic and monetary policy restrictions and fiscal policy restrictions initiated by the Fed and by the Biden administration brought inflation under control. The U.S. actually had less inflation than other developed countries in the world. And right now we have the strongest economy in the world, bar none. And that's not my opinion. That's the World Bank's opinion. And we know that we are in a good position going forward with inflation because it's been very stable for about a year. The Trump people are planning to declare victory on inflation going forward. And people like Peter Navarro are just fear-mongering.
Yeah, now the inflation thing, I've been arguing that it didn't matter who the president was going to be. We were going to have a bout of inflation. And I would argue, had Trump won in 2020, I think it would be even worse than it is now. Now, again, you can't prove any of this because, ultimately, Joe Biden is president. We've had this inflation. It's at his doorstep. But I got to tell you, again, I'm not an economist. I could be close to Peter Navarro. But it seems to me that it didn't matter who the president was going to be. We were going to get hit with this.
Yeah, virtually everyone who actually studies macroeconomic policy trends agreed that inflation was a sort of a phenomenon that was a global phenomenon and was a direct response to the supply chain restrictions and the changes in consumer habits and consumer spending that were either temporarily created by the COVID-19 pandemic or permanently altered as we changed our behaviors in response to that pandemic. Things cost more now than they did in 2020. And of course, there was a slight period of deflation at the onset of the pandemic in 2020 when the global economy ground to a halt and like gasoline, or not gasoline, but oil was trading for negative prices for a time. It actually was costing companies more money to hold that oil than to just give it away for less than it was worth. And no one wants to go back to March and April of 2020 when prices were crashing all around the country and all around the world. But, you know, inflation for the first time in about 40 years popped up above the traditional standards of 2 to 3 to 4% that people are normal, that people consider normal and are used to seeing. And we had this transitory spike that has since abated. And the Biden administration has been afraid to take credit for it. And the mainstream media has been afraid to declare that that inflation has been tackled. But most of the economists agree, like the problem of inflation is perhaps perhaps all the way in the rearview mirror. And there's increasing evidence that some of the inflation that we see, some of the reason that it's remained a little bit higher is because the monetary restrictions are still in place, which are driving up the prices of some things like rent and housing. And those are key components of our inflation metrics. If we could do less restrictive monetary policy, there's a good argument that you might see inflation come back down again toward that 2% number. But it's been hovering around 3% for 12 months, 13 months, depending on which metric you use. And every other administration in history would have claimed that as a victory. It's really one of the most stable 13-month periods that you can find in the publicly available inflation data. We've never seen anything quite like this. But the public and the media, mainstream and right-wing alike, largely think of this as a major failure of the administration. And it's something they haven't been able to get away from.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think Joe Biden has done a very good job managing all of these crises that have come through and getting us to this point, especially if you look at the rest of the world. Now, me personally, you know, this wouldn't be as much of a problem if we had a much stronger labor movement, if workers had the ability to have cost of living adjustments in their contracts to ensure that when inflation does go up, their standard of living doesn't get eroded. So for me, the idea of maybe we need to be doing a bunch more organizing and getting people with contracts sounds about right. Now, you had Teamsters President Sean O'Brien who showed up and you're making the overture there. There's talk, and I don't know if you watched J.D. Vance's speech, but, you know, a lot of talk about, you know, the Republican Party being the party of the working class and tacitly somewhat coming close to saying they might be okay with unions, even though their record shows anything but support for labor. I'm curious if your thought of, you know, this whole political theater thing here around they're the party of the working class.
You know, this is something that I think Ted Cruz was the first person to try to road test this in the lead up to the 2016 election. And then the populist movement that followed along with Donald Trump, his sort of blue collar billionaire branding, has really taken over a lot of the sort of veneer and auspices of the party. But the Republican Party has worked very hard to reframe itself, particularly working to reframe the media angle, that it's no longer like just the party of business, it's also the party of workers. But J.D. Vance is the sort of avatar of this. He's supposed to be this person from humble beginnings, blue collar background, who comes in and isn't necessarily aligned with the Trumpist or the orthodox Republican policies of cutting taxes and reducing regulations, and instead is more focused on renewing investments into forgotten communities around the country. There's just a couple of problems with this. One, J.D. Vance actually doesn't oppose the tax cuts and deregulations that are general Republican orthodoxies, which Trump pursued in his first term, which Project 2025 has outlined for Trump's second term, and which J.D. Vance has largely gone along with and is going to fall in line with behind his new boss, Donald Trump, as they run their 2024 campaign. But in addition to the fact that he's going to fall in line behind this, he's also not actually the kind of, not the perfect avatar for this that he's maybe been made out to be from right-wing and mainstream media outlets alike. You know, J.D. Vance wants to highlight the hillbilly elegy part of his background and not highlight the venture capitalist in Silicon Valley part of his background. He's very proud of talking about his Ivy League education, but then this is the same group of people who often use the Ivy League pedigree as a cudgel when it's brandished by their liberal opponents. You know, of the people who are running in the 2024 election, the ones who are Ivy League educated are Trump and Vance, and the ones who went to public schools or to supposedly lesser schools to get their undergraduate and graduate educations are Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. Ironically, this kind of anti-elite, anti-establishment populist movement within the Republican Party has picked up these two people as its avatars, Trump and Vance now, who couldn't possibly be more elitist. You know, like J.D. Vance did have humble beginnings, and he's been incredibly successful since then. But like, he lives in a house that has that's valued at $2 million on the east in East Walnut Hills in Cincinnati. I grew up in Cincinnati. I know the neighborhood his house is in. It is a palace. This is not like the blue collar stock that is often portrayed in the media and that was trying to be portrayed last night at the RNC. You know, these are elites. And, you know, Mitt Romney was willing to embrace that about himself. But it's something that Trump and the Republican Party under Trump has been has put great effort into whitewashing and restoring.
Yeah, I mean, during his speech, he did try to play up the, you know, the hillbilly Horatio Alger angle. And didn't talk much about his days as the as you pointed out. Now you guys you actually have some backstory with J.D. Vance, no?
Yeah, I don't have any personal history with J.D. Vance, but he and I went to Ohio State at the same time, and got political science degrees.
I thought it was the Ohio State.
I try not to be pretentious. The capital "the" is in our name. I try not to be pretentious about it. But he graduated in the summer of 2009 with a degree in political science. I graduated in the spring of 2009. I don't actually have a personal memory of J.D. Vance, though at the time he had a different last name. He adopted his grandparents' last name in 2014 when he was writing his memoir, where he highlighted his background with them. So maybe I forgot him because his last name was Hamels at the time. But we went to school at the same time. We went to the same university at the exact same time, studied the same discipline, and we had very divergent paths from there forward. I think it's kind of interesting, you know, we also are both from Southwest Ohio, which is not Appalachia. We have grandparents who lived in Appalachia, but, you know, technically the house I grew up in Cincinnati was a little bit closer physically to what the Appalachian Regional Commission defines as that territory than the house he grew up in Middletown, Ohio. That notwithstanding, you know, there are these sort of eerie similarities that are very strange when I look at them in hindsight, particularly to see someone so young. He's the youngest vice presidential hopeful aspirant since Richard Nixon in 1952. And I think J.D. Vance being in company with Richard Nixon probably should raise the red flags that you think it might raise.
No, I mean, for me, look, the guy has an interesting story. I mean, definitely you know, one of those really great kind of American tales we like to tell ourselves, that if you work hard, you play by the rules, you can go as high as you want to go. But it seems to me, and you can help me here if you think I'm wrong, it seems that, you know, there are a lot of people who get to climb that ladder and then want to pull it up behind them or kick it off the side of the building so no one else gets to follow it. And I see his policies and I see his positioning as doing that.
Yeah, and this is something that is very rarely talked about, particularly when the mainstream press picks up these sort of Horatio Alger stories, as you're describing, this sort of bootstrapping narrative of someone who is self-made and who's enterprising and entrepreneurial, is a question of whether or not you should be closing the door behind you when doors were opened for you. You know, J.D. Vance is someone who benefited from a great deal of the smaller programs that are made available to individuals like himself. For instance, he went to school for free on the GI Bill. He deserved that. He signed up. He signed his name on the dotted line. He served with honor. So far as we know, he served with honor and distinction in a non-combatant role in the United States Marine Corps during the Iraq War. You know, he got the benefits and the entitlements that he had earned and that he deserved. But then the question is, why are you running as a part of a campaign, as a part of an edifice? Why are you being funded by organizations and individuals and supported by a media infrastructure that wants to take away those benefits from everyone who follows after you?
Yeah, it's an interesting story, and one clearly that's going to get a lot more attention going down the road, is especially the part where he started off being a kind of a never Trumper and said, you know, Trump was what was the line he used, not ready for the highest office, or you know, not capable, or whatever that was, and then something along the line of a Hitler character. So, any of this ringing vaguely familiar?
I think the initial story came out in 2019, maybe it was 2019 or 2021. J.D. Vance had texted with a former roommate of his who he stayed in contact with as an adult. And lots of us, you know, I have a text thread with some of my friends that goes back to 2012, where we mostly talk about football. But he had texted with a friend of his that he saw Donald Trump, and the quote was as quote America's Hitler. Now that is generally considered to be a bad thing, and typically this sort of hypocrisy when someone like Paul Ryan or someone like Lindsey Graham, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, when they pivot and embrace Trump, that hypocrisy doesn't really land very well outside of the sort of the political bubble echo chamber that we have in DC. Like, elite media focus on the sort of hypocrisy angles, but most people don't really care about that stuff. But the direct quote is America's Hitler. And it's one of the reasons that we've seen that quote come up so much in media since he was rising through the vice presidential vetting system, is because, you know, comparing someone to Hitler is like, that is the worst person that we have in our recorded human history. Like,
kind of hard to take that back.
You can't do worse than being America's Hitler. Yeah, and like you said, it's hard to take back. The Republicans and the right-wing media apparatus around them are going to try to memory hold that, as they've successfully memory hold many things. But that's one that does seem to have some staying power, and that's why you continue to see it requoted and revisited in media, and particularly on social media, because it really is such a highlight of how much this person, it's not just that he has changed, he has fundamentally changed aspects of himself in pursuit of this sort of political goal. And he's been helped along with these financial backers and these media supporters, from Tucker Carlson to Peter Thiel, who themselves have badmouthed Trump along the way while riding this gravy train. And now they kind of all arrive together at this moment in 2024, where they're back on the cusp of retaking power. And someone like J.D. Vance, the sort of naked opportunism of it is just difficult to ignore.
Yeah. Now, you guys took history classes, and you said about the same thing, because I listened to his speech and it sounded much like it sounded like talk radio history. It sounded like revisionist history that, Joe Biden's all bad and, well, you know, nothing, there was nothing on this side, nothing to see here. Blamed Biden for Iraq, blamed him for NAFTA, blamed him for everything, forgetting the other half of the story.
Yeah, those were pretty rich, you know. So the specific blames were, he blamed Joe Biden for NAFTA, he blamed Joe Biden for the permanent normalization of trade relations with China, and he blamed Joe Biden for the Iraq War. But the people who were responsible for NAFTA were George Herbert Walker Bush and Bill Clinton. Joe Biden voted for those things, but he was a senator. He wasn't the president. And then the person who was responsible for normalization of trade relations with China was Clinton, and then W. Bush. And then, of course, the Iraq War was all Bush. But it's a good example where a foreign policy blunder like Iraq can be so devastating and so problematic that the Republicans are now trying to use it for the third consecutive election cycle to damage their Democratic opponent. It was perhaps one of the most damaging things in 2016. 2016 came to be defined by emails, but the media and the public were willing to glom onto those emails because they just were inherently distrustful of someone who had voted for the Iraq War and been such a prominent figure in it, which was Hillary Clinton. The Trump people tried this again in 2020, used it somewhat to no avail against Joe Biden in that election. And now they're bringing it up again in 2024, hopeful to land like one last blow. It would be fascinating to see if the Iraq War ended up being sort of a decisive turning point in these consecutive elections being used as a cudgel against Democrats' opponents. It's actually four consecutive elections with Kerry, Clinton, Biden, and now Biden again, all being held to the standard when it was a Republican administration that led us into that war. Senators voted for it, but presidents are the ones who are responsible for foreign policy, particularly as commander in chief of the military.
No, look, I've got a friend who was in Congress at the time and said, you know, I can't tell you what we were shown, but there's no question if you saw what I saw, you would have voted for it too. So, you know, it wasn't Joe Biden's fault, but, you know, we are where we are. But, Craig, I appreciate the time, the thoughts. Last question I've got for you, you know, the ratings. I know Trump is a big ratings guy. Is this convention landing, do you think? I mean, it's interesting to see who they're pulling, and not a lot of star power, not a lot of big names. But is this resonating, do you think? Think there are ratings here?
You know, I don't have the ratings numbers off the top of my head, but it has been pretty widely discussed that ratings are down for this convention based on previous years. So the 2020 and 2016 conventions particularly 2016 had had significant pop and had a lot of ratings spectacle by comparison to what we see now. And it's not just that the ratings are down. The energy in the room is kind of deflated. If you watch any aspects of it, it's not loud. Even J.D. Vance's keynote address last night, which didn't happen until after 11 p.m., he actually missed his primetime window to give his speech because they were so delayed by other things. But it was all very low energy. It was very quiet. The room feels like it's not full. Not a lot of people are watching. Obviously, millions of people are watching, but it's nothing compared to prior conventions. And word on the street from inside Milwaukee, I have a couple of friends and acquaintances through social media who live in the area and who are there. And they're talking about how, like, this is the time to go to that restaurant that you always had trouble getting a reservation to, because most Milwaukeeans kind of evacuated the city to get away from the chaos that they thought the convention would be. And as a result, it's kind of a ghost town in the area around the convention. Some of that might also be because of the increased security perimeter in the wake of the shooting, you know, just a week ago, which feels like it was years ago at this point in the news cycle. But it's not well attended. It's not well watched on TV, and it's really low energy. I don't know how well it's landing, in part because it's just a secondary news story at this point.
Yeah, no, it's going to be interesting to see how they spin the numbers. Maybe they'll bring Sean Spicer back to say it was the biggest, greatest ever. But Craig, as always, great stuff, man. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Craig Harrington, research director there at Media Matters. Check out their website, mediamatters.org. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around.
This is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH. This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Partly cloudy for tonight, a low in the upper 50s. And a partly sunny weekend's in store for us, highs close to 80, a few pop-up storms around. It warms into the low 80s for early next week, a little more humid, and still the chance of showers and storms. Currently at 62 degrees.
The Todd Allbush Show.
Andrew Hahn, he is a data journalist, and he maps out in this article what makes Wisconsin great. 96% of Wisconsinites live within 30 minutes of Quick Trip.
Wisconsin is one of those places that has a cultural identity that's unique to this place. And when we tell stories like this, it reminds people that we all come from this place and we all share a goal, genuinely, of trying to make this state a better place.
The Todd Allbush Show. Weekdays, noon till 2. On your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I gotta tell you, I'm still, my mind is still in this place of Mark Wayne Mullen and Sean O'Brien. We have a love. I just, it's, you know. Yeah, it's one of those things that, understand, I think you have to talk to the other side. I think you have to talk to people you disagree with. I do it all the time. I think you have to have open lines of communication. But this charm offensive that we know is not going to bear fruit. In fact, you know, I go back to what the National Review guy said. Look, the appeal to union members by Trump, the appeal by to union members by this current iteration of the GOP is cultural, not ideological. It means it's a cult. They're in it because of Trump, not because of Mark Wayne Mullen or Josh Hawley or J.D. Vance or any of them, because, again, their policies are horrible. But at least we have a love. And that's a start, right? You know, much like Romeo and Juliet, their parents really didn't want them to get married. And that's not a good analogy. Never mind. Anyway, let's move along to find out what this might mean. Maybe I'm reading this wrong. And that's why I've asked our good friend Sarah Burris to come talk with us. Sarah's a reporter at Raw Story, rawstory.com, the website. Sarah, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, how the heck are you?
I'm good. You know, I'm looking at this stuff, and look, I don't want to be cynical. I don't want to be in this position where I'm questioning the general president of my union. But I got to tell you, it just seems like a lot of unforced errors for what I see down the road is nothing bearing fruit other than, well, Donald J. Trump in the White House.
I think that that's the really sad thing is that if you are trying to make an ally to achieve your goal, then I get it. This will not turn into any kind of support for union rules or organizing or ending right to work in Oklahoma, which is where Mark Wayne Mullen is from. I mean, all of these things are still going to exist, except now you basically just look like a tool used by Donald Trump. And, you know, I don't know. It made me think of the Kim Jong-un letters, you know, where Donald Trump was like, oh, we wrote letters and then we fell in love.
Yeah.
And so maybe these guys just had breadsticks and...
And who doesn't love breadsticks? But you know, here's the thing, and this is one of those things where you go, what is it about Donald Trump that he can get J.D. Vance to you know apologize for all of the things that he said about Donald Trump and sell his soul to be VP? And what is it about him that got you know Sean O'Brien to come to Mag-a-Lago, got Mark Wayne Mullen who wanted to you know. Knock him out to go and have dinner together, and now there's a love. What is it about Trump? Is he really that good at bringing people together? Is he that great of a matchmaker?
Well, I want to say like Trump has brought the right together with the far right in a way that nobody else has been able to do. So there is that. I think a lot of these folks, I mean, especially with J.D. Vance, he has some comments that he's made that are really weird about, you know, well, I may as well, you know, go this way. And it didn't really seem genuine to me at all that he's turned MAGA, but it's that same sort of sycophantic branding kind of thing that I, you know, I am a person, an identity, the way that Trump is. Like there's so much of that I think that is similar between the two of them that it really makes sense for Trump to have picked him outside of the fact that everybody was lobbying for him. Don Jr. was lobbying for him, everybody else. But there is so much of that where it's like we both have these individual personalities outside of politics because of, you know, his little hillbilly book and Trump's little buildings.
Look, I'm not going to diminish their accomplishments, but ultimately they're not good for the country. And I find it interesting because my mind is going in this place. I remember the Sean O'Brien that I voted for and actually bought the shirt. I actually have a Sean O'Brien shirt. Was a guy who was marching in the streets with Bernie Sanders. Was talking a very progressive tone. And then, you know, being in Washington, D.C. for a little bit of time has now taken this dive to the right, it seems, and you know, at the beck and call of someone like Trump, who, you know, look, maybe it'll be a good thing down the road, and maybe I'm wrong, but I gotta tell you, I agree with the National Review, and it's rare that happens, that what we're seeing is cultural, not ideological, which means we're not getting any votes.
Well, I think Sean O'Brien said it himself whenever he did an interview with CNN with Dana Bash. I think it was the day after he spoke at the convention. He said on air, Joe Biden has been the most pro-labor president, you know, we've ever had. And so, again, like his whole speech was not about the Republicans are going to do this for working people. They're going to, you know, allow us to organize. It's not, you know, this is how we as a union and as union members will benefit. It was very much about, you know, the cult of personality around Donald Trump. And then he goes on CNN and says, but actually Joe Biden has been the most labor president we've ever had. So it's just a very strange.
It is.
I don't get it. I don't get it either.
But what's interesting to me, Sarah, is that he is the most talked about thing out of this convention. Everybody I talk to, And I've been talking to a lot of people recently. They don't care about anybody else that's been on that stage. They care about Sean O'Brien being there. And why is he there? Not talking about, hey, how can we organize into unions? How can we get what he was selling? But shocked that he's there. And look, the RNC ratings have not been great. So, you know, most people didn't actually see what happened. They just know he was there, which, you know, again, you're at the big pep rally. And if you're at the pep rally, you're probably cheering for the guy. So that's what most people, I think, believe.
That has been really interesting to look at the ratings part of this. And I'll be curious to see how the Democratic Convention goes. And it may just be that the Democratic Convention gets a whole lot of press and attention because it's, you know, 68 all over again. But the first night, I think, was their highest performing night. And they had something like 18 million. The second night it dropped to 14 million.
Wow.
Biden made a comment on his Twitter page where he said something to the effect of, my NATO speech got 6 million more views than the first night of Donald Trump's convention. I think, you know, to be fair, his NATO speech was a really important speech. So there is that. But, you know, again, like this, the people who were there the first night and arguably the second night, it was the most boring thing I've ever seen. And what's sad is like they've really tried to play up this diversity thing. They had a woman who was Sikh who came to give a prayer, I think it was last night, and was booed. And then the internet, like all of the conservatives on the internet, just completely eviscerated her. J.D. Vance's wife.
How do you go after a prayer?
Right? Like, that's the thing. And I mean, J.D. Vance's wife, very conservative, probably one of the most celebrated, experienced conservative attorneys that the Republican Party has. Like, she clerked for the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. She clerked, unfortunately, for Kavanaugh, before Kavanaugh was in the Supreme Court. Like, she's a big deal. She's conservative, but she's a big deal. And she's Indian. Her parents were, I think she's first generation. I think her parents emigrated here from India, and she's Hindu. And the things that they have said about her, all the conservatives going after her on Twitter have just been unacceptable, like really gross and really sad. And then, you know, Daily Beast wrote a story where they were like, now they're going to turn her into a trad wife, which I really hope doesn't happen just for her own sake.
No, I mean, but here's the thing, you know, that what we're seeing on display at this political theater event is, you know, wanting to take women back to the 1950s. And I look at J.D. Vance and I look at the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025, and it's all about repealing the 20th century and, you know, putting women back in the kitchen and blacks back in the field and gays back in the closet. That's basically their platform.
Yeah, the thing in the Project 2025 is, I even want to say it's on like page 451, if you want to look it up, defines a family as a father who works, a mother who stays at home, and children. So any family outside of that is not normal. If you have a single mother, you're no longer a normal family under the Republican rules. If you are, if your parents died during COVID and you're living with your grandparents, congratulations, you're no longer a family.
So J.D. Vance doesn't have a normal family. He didn't come from a normal family, is what you're telling me.
Not only did he not come from a normal family, he's not in a normal family. Like, his family is not a normal family. Yes, he's a little U.S. senator, but his wife's a big deal. Conservative, but a big deal. It reminds me, honestly, of Dan Quayle whenever he went after Murphy Brown and said that she was having a child out of wedlock and, you know, that's not what a family is and yada yada. And it's like, you people have been saying that women have a choice, you know, forever. That includes deciding to have the child, and she decided to have the child. And then you're saying that this isn't a family now? Like, I mean, the whole thing about the Republican Party from the early days of defining how families should be, and this idea of ruling the way your bedrooms work and what relationships you can have. Like, it used to be a Republican Party that was, did not want to be that dictatorial, did not want to be, I want to say up your uterus.
Yeah. No, but here's the thing.
This is where we are now.
They, look, I know a lot of very conservative people, and they all believe that they're under attack. They believe that they're being oppressed. And like I've always said, if you want to look at tomorrow's oppressors, look at today's oppressed, or the people who believe that they're being oppressed. And I'll bet you, if you walk through that convention hall, I'll bet you those people believe that, you know, this cultural stuff, it's oppressing us. I'll bet you they believe that.
It's all, it's this idea of I deserve the right to destroy you. And it is my right to hate you and to make your life miserable and to make rules about the way that your life should be. That's what they think it is their freedom to do. And and if they are not able to then attack somebody or kill somebody or make fun of somebody or essentially destroy somebody's life, then that's not freedom to them.
Yeah. No, there's been a lot of stuff in this that, you know, I think the American people are uncomfortable with. I happened to watch a mother who lost a child to fentanyl, and you know attacking Joe Biden. It's all Joe Biden's fault. And I'm going, it's so much more than just that. And I'm uncomfortable with the party using that tragedy as something that is that fair game? Let me ask you that way. Is it fair game to throw that out there, to take that woman's horribly tragic, heart-wrenching story, of which, I was angry and I felt horrible for this woman, but to then go and pivot and go, it's all Joe Biden's fault. I don't know. I'm struggling with that. Or am I missing something?
No, I think that makes sense. For every woman who is like that, who's blaming Joe Biden, there's somebody else who lost someone during Donald Trump's administration. Who lost somebody during Obama's administration. Like, it's not any one president's fault. This is a problem that the country is facing. And when we make something like that partisan, I think it removes the possibility of any kind of success in curbing it or solving any of these problems, because it's turned it to such a political issue, and it shouldn't be. It should be something that everybody is behind.
Let me stump you then, because some of my Teamster friends who did think it was okay that O'Brien went to the RNC said exactly that. We've got to make that overture so that stuff's not acceptable, that we then bridge that gap, and because nobody wants anyone to die from fentanyl overdoses or these horrible things. Isn't that kind of the argument?
I think that would make sense if the RNC was receptive to any of the things that the Teamsters want as a union.
Yep.
If Donald Trump was some paragon of fixing the opioid crisis, then I would say tally-ho, right? But that's not what he is. He basically created a blue ribbon panel and sent everybody on with their day. So I think, this idea that somehow Joe Biden is to blame
for everything. If you watch the convention, everything. The sun went down 10 minutes early. Joe Biden's fault. The sun's going down sooner now than it did yesterday. It's all Joe Biden's fault.
I mean, it really has become comical. It kind of made me want to start making memes where I just look for the lawn chair fell over in the wind. Ah, Joe Biden. Because it's just so absurd. It reached this level of just silliness.
You know what else is silly to me? I gotta be honest. I'm looking at all these people with sanitary napkins on their ear, and I gotta tell you, I don't know. It reminds me of 2004 when everyone was wearing Purple Heart Band-Aids. If you remember the Bush convention of 2004. It reminds me of that kind of idiocy, only you're gonna wear, and you're gonna wear a giant, you know, cotton thing on your ear. I don't know. It seems odd to me. Seems weird. Seems cultish.
Definitely, if you listen to, there's actually a podcast about cults and cultism by this expert who has studied them for years, and she talks about different things that are cults. And so I really want her to do a show about that where they talked about it. I don't know about you, but my mother was blowing up my phone with memes. Like, she was sending me so many different memes of the ear. Like, one of them that said "My Pillow" on it. One of them that was made up to look like a Klan hood. I mean, it was pretty funny. And then there's like a whole crew of doctors and nurses who are online talking about how this is stupid because that's not how you would dress a wound like that. And that, you know, the day after the shooting, Trump was playing golf with no bandage on it. And now, of course, you know, he's at the RNC, so he's got to wear a bandage on it.
I
thought for sure it was just going to get bigger and bigger every day, you know, until it just, like, he was Van Gogh.
No, absolutely. But here's the thing. The guy is a political mastermind when it comes to perception, to the whole presentation. He's a TV guy. To him, this is just like any other TV show trying to get ratings out of. And you got to give him credit for being able to know the moment and use everything at his disposal. I wish Democrats had a little bit of that showmanship because they actually got a pretty good record to run on if he could deliver the punchline. So last question I got for you, does Biden make it to convention time? Is there an open convention? What do you think is going to happen in the August iteration of convention series?
Honestly, I have no idea. I saw Mark Halperin make a comment on, Mark Halperin's a commentator on Newsmax, just to clarify. So I don't really know about this dude, but he said that Joe Biden's going to drop out on Saturday or Sunday. And so I don't know. I think it's really sad that they've basically chased him out.
See, my problem is, Sarah, I saw the debate, and that was a major unforced error by the campaign. Look, I don't know how he is, you know, behind closed doors, but that Thursday debate, a lot of people lost faith in him. As I've said, I'll vote for a ham sandwich before I'll vote for Donald Trump. But he did not instill a lot of I'm sorry. I love Joe Biden, but didn't do
it
for me.
What has been interesting in that aftermath is looking at the extent to which that matters to people. And I think people still, most of the people who are voting for Joe Biden don't see it as a vote for Joe Biden. They see it as a vote against Donald Trump, right, or a vote for democracy, or a vote for, you know, whatever issue du jour matters to them that Trump is against. And I think that there is this built-in group of voters who are going to support the Democratic nominee or a non-Trump person across the board.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that that's the way it's going to work out. It's going to be the House and the Senate that matter.
Yeah, each side has their base. As you know, as well as anyone else, presidential elections are about a handful of voters in a handful of states. And for me, this is where I've made that choice. I know some people who have lost faith because Joe hasn't been able to deliver the punchline. You got to be able to, if you're going to take out a bully, you got to be able to throw the punch. And it just, some people are like, I don't know. Anyway,
I was really hoping that he would end up at the Democratic convention, like doing a Willy Wonka thing. You know, where he like walks out with a cane and then like does a somersault and is like, with his top hat. No, I think that would have been so bad.
It's not going to happen. He'd break a hip and that would be bad. Why put that in someone's head?
I think it's cool. Plus it's the like head. The purple jacket with the tails.
Got it. Sarah, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. Have an awesome rest of the week.
You as well. Our good friend Sarah Burris. Make sure you check out her work at Raw Story. RawStory.com, the website. Gonna take a quick break. Right back to wrap things up. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1993. That was the day that President Bill Clinton announced his Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. He had campaigned for president, promising to allow all citizens to serve in the military, regardless of sexual orientation. Once he was elected, there was a great deal of opposition to his proposal. Military officials railed against the idea of lifting the ban on homosexuals in the military. Members of Congress and the public voiced opposition. President Clinton proposed a compromise he called Don't Ask, Don't Tell. This meant that military officials were not supposed to inquire about the sexual orientation of servicemen and women. Service members were not to be public about their sexual preference. This meant that if members of the LGBT community wanted to pursue a career in the military, they had to hide a significant part of who they were or risk losing their jobs. The policy stood in effect for nearly two decades. More than 12,000 officers lost their jobs because they refused to stay in the closet. It is also unknown how many more LGBT people decided not to apply for military service because of the discriminatory division. President Obama pledged to repeal the policy during his first election. It took 2 years after his election until Don't Ask, Don't Tell was finally ended by Congress. Some members of Congress issued dire warnings about repealing the discriminatory policy. But on the fifth anniversary of the repeal, President Obama issued this statement. Today, Americans can serve the country they love, no matter who they love. And openly gay, lesbian, and bisexual men and women in uniform make our military stronger and America safer.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as we wrap up this week, you know, the convention, I got to tell you, it was, as far as shows going, kind of boring. Honestly, truthfully, there wasn't an awful lot there. I know they tried to look more diverse. They tried to do a whole bunch of things. But ultimately, it didn't seem like there was a lot of enthusiasm, even in the crowd so much. It was a lot of the same old retreads, a lot of the same old stuff, and the same old policies. Look, ultimately, for me, as someone who's fairly wonky, I want to make lives better with policy, not cults, not individuals, but how do we make work better? How do we make lives better? And as a labor guy, I can't, my mind, and this is where my bias comes in. I'm going to tell you that I'm 100% ideologically biased against Donald Trump because I saw what he did in the 4 years that he was president. A guy who has said he's in favor of right-to-work laws. I'm 100% opposed to that. A guy who, quite frankly, wants to push a lot of the anti-worker stuff that his NLRB did. But overall, the Republican Party has been one of those groups of repeal prevailing wage. They wanted to push that paycheck protection nonsense, which all that means, and it's great language, paycheck. Who could be against paycheck protection? But all it says is, well, you employers can't agree to deduct dues from the paycheck for unions to collect. No, it's illegal. And understand, you go through all of the things that they did, all the restrictions that they put on collective bargaining, all the opportunity, the chances to prohibit project labor agreements, limiting unions' ability to do political work, unlike the churches who we've unleashed. You go down the list, and this Project 2025 is very real. They want to ban public sector workers from unionizing. They want to ban the unions entirely. They want to be able to fire through their Schedule F, all civil servants, and replace them with good loyalists so they can make patronage great again. They want to eliminate, and this is one of those things that just blows my mind, they want to be able to eliminate contracts midway through. So if an employer decides, you know what, I don't want to do this anymore, okay. The other one for everyone that everyone should be worried about, they want to change the way overtime is calculated. Instead of a 40-hour work week, you have a 160-hour work month. So, yeah, if you work 100 hours in the first week, well, and do you think you're going to get a chance to have a say in that? Of course not. They're in the process of eliminating child labor laws. And J.D. Vance's own pet interest, letting employers create their own company-run unions. It seems like to me, we're going backwards with this party. Now, again, as someone who has done a lot of reading about labor's history, I kind of know what the 1880s, 1890s looked like, and they weren't a good place for workers, especially children. And this is my problem with all of this. We've got to force poor people to have children. Because why? Well, we need cheap labor for the very people in that rotunda who are on the rolls of the Amazons and the... never mind. $45 million a month from Elon Musk to Donald Trump from now till election time. If nothing screams tax the rich more than that, I don't know what does. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. And as always, I appreciate you being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@thericksmithshow.com. This is the Buzz of the North. WBZH 910 AM. W245 CT Hayward. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.